So did I succeed in freaking you out more?
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. This is Gerardo Poli.
And this, sorry.
I'm Gerardo Poli.
I'm Hubert Himstra, and this is the Vet Vault. Today's episode is a bit of a mix between our standard performance episode and the clinical ones. We speak to Dr. Randolph Burrell, who owns and works in a feline-only practice in Sydney, Australia. But Randolph doesn't just like staying up to date with what's new for his patients. He prefers to be at the forefront by doing his own research. This has led to him gaining his memberships in feline medicine and a PhD in clinical pathology and being a contributor on VIN and authoring a string of publications and articles on all things ClinPath.
We talked to Randolph about the benefits of niche practice and about being a researcher while also being a clinician. But the bulk of our conversation is around Randolph's insight around his pet topic, which is what I loved the most about this podcast, which is how to interpret our blood results and specifically how we should be thinking about the results that we get. Now, a quick word of warning, some of the things Randolph talks about might hurt your brain because it definitely hurt mine, but I guarantee that once things start to click into place, you will wonder how it is that you never thought about things in this way.
A quick story about this. Soon after we did this interview, I happened to go to the doctor for some routine blood results, and it was a very experienced doctor. And when the bloods came back, we sat there together going through them, and there were a couple of line ball results that she was a bit concerned about. And then I explained to her what Randolph just taught me, and I loved it. I could literally see the penny dropping, going, ah, that aha moment that I hope that all of you get to experience while you listen to this episode. So please enjoy Dr. Randolph Burrell and his rubbery numbers. Welcome, Randolph, and thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me. Appreciate it.
And Gerardo, there in the background.
Hey, team.
Randolph, I want to start with your everyday life. We want to get to your research and the mind-opening, mind-expanding stuff that you're talking and writing about. But I just want to start with your everyday life and your life as a vet, because you are also a GP veterinarian / practice owner. Is that right?
Yep. I've owned a cat-only practice with my wife, Melissa, for 24 years now. And I was in general small animal practice for about 10 years prior to that. So now that I'm doing a bit more research, I've reduced my hours a little bit from that. So I probably work about two-thirds of a load in the practice, but I'm seeing on a regular, pretty well daily basis, cats coming in as first opinion cases, as well as doing my research.
I've got colleagues who aren't so keen on dogs or on cats, and they've opened dog-only clinics. Have you ever heard of dog-only clinics?
I haven't heard about dog-only clinics, but I can see that there's, you know, I'm not dogist at all. I'm very happy for people to do that. I can see more of a need for it for cats, because cats get more stressed in and having practitioners and nurses who are familiar with cat behaviour does help with that. And also we just find that stuff that seems really, really routine for us, when we see histories from other vets coming in, we just see that they're just not keyed into cat specific stuff. I did always feel a bit stretched when I was cats, dogs, let alone when the ferrets or guinea pigs or whatever came in, and I think it's good that there are people who see the exotics specifically as well, and I think that caters for the needs of the clientele.
Yeah, we at emergency, we see probably around about 80% dogs and about 15% cats and 5% exotics. But when they come in, it's like, I suppose they got some, most cat emergencies, like there's some very common cat emergencies.
They all begin with B. They've got blocked bladders, breathing problems, birthing problems, or they're bleeding out. So,
okay. Well, there we go. But then when it's not one of those Bs, it's kind of like, okay, now we're in the world of viruses and stuff, and I don't know.
I'd say I've never heard of dog-only practices, and my first reflex is to go, all right, that's just people who aren't comfortable working with cats, because they're challenging, let's face it, they can be challenging. But in a way, it's almost an admission to say, look, cats are challenging in terms of their diseases, they are different, and it's not my thing, and I'm going to focus on what I'm good at. Maybe that's not a bad way to go. So, well, I'm going to reduce my own stress and do the things that I like to do.
It's interesting that when you talk about cats being challenging, it's just normal for me. You know, after 24 years, that's just normal. And I almost can't imagine doing a physical examination on a Newfoundland these days.
They're backbreaking, especially when you're trying to do a musculoskeletal exam.
Do you think you can narrow your practice down to a dogs only dogs between 5 and 15 kilograms?
I have heard about these small dog practice. I think I heard about a small dog and bird practice in Los Angeles or something. So
wow,
worthwhile looking up online to see if that truly exists or I just dreamt it.
it's actually the nice thing about our career is you, especially if it's your own practice. You know, you can choose what you want to do. We complain about this and this, and then cut it out of your life. If you don't want to see it, say, well, I'll let somebody else deal with that. I'll do the things that I'm good at. But
you set up a business model, you can get it working. And if you've got an idea that you can just work with that idea, then I think most things could work, and there should be a market for most things, and that should encourage people to come from further afield for those particular markets. Mark Peterson, who's the first guy who recognized hypothyroidism in cats, his practice in New York is an endocrine practice, so animal endocrine center. So why not?
And even if it's not your practice, you could almost structure your career. If you get really good at one thing, then it's almost like it will default that you will end up doing more of that, even within if it's obviously in a big practice. If you're sole charge, busy, mixed practice in the country, then well, tough, you're going to deal with everything. But I saw a question yesterday on a social media post about a vet saying, any advice for a vet who hates doing dentals, which is me. I'm like, well,
go do emergency.
but I did think, if that was me in practice, what would my strategy be? You don't want to be the vet who says, look, I'm not doing those anymore. But conversely, you can say, look, I'm going to get really good at dermatology or the ultrasounds and that, and then default, you're going to get sucked into that to the point where your employer is going to say, well, you're terrible at dentists, I'm not going to let you do the dentists, but you're really good at this other thing, so just do that thing.
Well, even when I was in general small animal practice, the nurse would come out the back in the old days before computers with a card and say, oh, we've got two clients waiting, here's the dog, and of course, Randolph, you see the cat. And without even me realizing that I had an affinity with cats, the people around me, the nurse, realized, and Melissa, my wife, found the same thing.
Even between fixing cats and running a practice, you also do quite a lot of research, which that fascinates me as well. I always have this, I think most people have this perception that you're either a clinician or you go down the research path, because research is this weird thing that you have to be super committed to and engaged in to do that. It's a sort of one or the other. But you buck that trend. First of all, how did you start down the research path?
In the first instance, I was just interested in cases with things that I hadn't seen before. So I wrote up interesting case reports. And case reports are quite, I think of like gateway research, you know, we could talk about. So, and ultimately, case reports became case series. And then by accident, I ended up down this clinical pathology path, which is the main area that I'm working on. But I already did have that experience of the case reports and case series. So my main area now is clinical pathology. And really that started when we were looking at changing in-house analyzers at our practice. And I just put a throwaway line on Vin asking what I should look for. And there was a response from a woman who's an American who's been in Scotland for a very long period of time by the name of Kathleen Freeman. And she opened my eyes that it's a lot more complicated than just running a couple of tests and seeing do they look the same or not. And I spoke to several of the companies and they were all very happy to loan us machines. So we... I can't remember what year it was now, must have been about 12 years ago, I think, that we had three in-house analyzers that we were running blood samples on cats on the three in-house analyzers, and also at the commercial laboratory. And before I knew it, I had this huge, huge, huge amount of data that I needed to start picking through. And one thing led to another, and someone said, why don't you write some papers on that? And someone else said, well, if you're writing several papers on the one area, why don't you look to do a master's or a PhD in that? So I did, and I've got a PhD in clinical pathology, and my first rejection led to my main area is the biological variation. So that's the physiological fluctuations of the things that we measure in the blood, but how much they fluctuate inside the body. And that came from a rejection of one of these papers that I submitted, and that they said, this needs to be compared to biological variation. And I looked it up and I said, there is no biological variation in cats. So I went out and set out and did that and determined that for cats, which was very satisfying. So that tends to be my main area. And I now maintain a vet biological variation website with a committee that I put together. And we're looking to have some tools to make these sort of ideas a bit more accessible to practitioners.
We are taking a very quick break to hear from our sponsors for this episode, Heska Australia, and we'll give you an idea for how you can make a bit more money. Then we'll get straight back to Randolph and rubbery numbers.
Thanks to our friends at Heska for bringing us this guest. If you haven't heard about the name Heska, then where have you been? Heska is the most exciting new player in the in-house lab equipment market in Australia. Or actually not that new, they're becoming pretty well known and pretty well established. So let's just say that Heska is a very exciting player in the in-house lab equipment market in Australia. Now, I know that if you're not a clinic owner, you're probably thinking that lab equipment isn't all that exciting, no matter who supplies it, but wait until you hear Hubert's plan.
You'd love a pay rise, right? So here's what you do. You ask your boss how much the clinic spent on consumables for your in-house labs last year. Then you go to Heska's website and crunch some numbers, or phone the team at Heska and they'll happily do it for you. And if your clinic is currently using a machine that allows you to run those individual dry slide tests, then you'll almost certainly save upwards of 30% or more compared to what your clinic has been paying to date. So then you go to your boss and here's what you say. You say, hey boss, if I can save the practice a substantial amount of money over the next year, can I keep half of what we save? And if she agrees, then Heska will supply your team with their boringly reliable machines for free through their reset program. And if you work in an even moderately busy clinic, then I'm pretty sure that you've just negotiated yourself a bonus in the tens of thousands of dollars. I challenge you to go and try it and let us know if it works. And if it does, drinks are on you at the next conference.
You're saying biological variation. Can you explain that?
Yeah, so basically everything we measure, so your urea, albumin, glucose, as well as variation that occurs within the machine that we're measuring on, which is what I started off doing the studies with, there's variation that happens in vivo in the cat or the dog, and it fluctuates on a daily, weekly, bi-monthly period. And that means that you can get blood results under the exact same circumstance, and the cat or dog or horse or whatever will have a variation in those results based on these natural physiological fluctuations. And the way we determine it is not that difficult in the first instance, and you actually don't need that many subjects because of the way that we go about it. And essentially you take blood samples from a set number, and generally your minimum number that you want to go for is 15, which in the terms of studies is not a huge number. But what you do is you then come back and do it a week later, and you keep everything the same. The diet's the same. You're doing it at about the same time of day. You're doing it fasted. We even do the animals in about the same order. And you keep all those blood samples and you deep freeze them, and then you run them all at the same time, and that's to minimize the variation that's happening at the lab. And by doing it weekly for 6 weeks, then running it at the lab in duplicate, you've got 15 times 6 times 2, and this multiplication factor gives you 180 samples, and that's what gives your study power, and you can actually determine the exact power of it based on the numbers that you end up getting. And then you run it through some statistics, and you used to have to use some pretty specialized statistical programs, but there are now some online programs that you can just pop the numbers in and get how much variation occurs for these different analytes that we're measuring. And you sort of look at it in various ways. You see how much variation is there between the different cats or dogs or horses, and how much variation is there within them, and how much variation do you have from the analyzer itself, and that's from the samples that you're running in duplicate. And there's just a huge amount of stuff that you can do with that data that, like I said, is relatively easy to collect.
That's excellent. But what did you find? What's the gist of your findings in this? Because I know the outcome because I've read some of your papers, and I'm going to be honest, I read it and I was like, this is really interesting, but I'm not really that happy reading it, because as a clinician, there's so much variation that we deal with already. And I love my lab numbers because it's literally in black and white. I've got this anchor, and it's in my head, that's irrefutable. The machine says, boop, there's my blood result, and now I can make decisions. And then I read your work, and I'm like, Randolph, now I have to think again.
Yeah, but it's like, sounds like there's variations in the machines, and there's variations in the body, and then
how do you interpret? Variations everywhere, and there's gray areas everywhere. And I think that's the biggest sort of important factor to do. And what's something really interesting that I've found, and so I talk about the gray areas around the numbers. So we Hubert talked about, he's happy that it's black and white, mm-hmm. and then he realized that it isn't. And that's a very common mistake, that we think of them as discrete results, and we think of them as fixed borders. That's a fixed result, and there's my fixed reference interval. Mm-hmm. But there is a gray area around each of them. And when those gray areas overlap, then that's why you have results that don't make sense. And it's really interesting that when I started putting this together, when you started to speak to some of the real top experts, top specialists in the world, they're automatically putting these gray areas around their numbers, around their reference intervals, around the discrete results. And I think that's the biggest take-home message, because I'm hoping to put together some tools that's going to make all this stuff a bit more accessible to practitioners. Mm-hmm. But in the first instance, if you just put a gray area around it and go, you know, this number is near the top of the reference interval, and if I think about a gray area around that result, and I think about a gray area around the reference interval, maybe that truly does represent an increase. I wonder what it was before. Oh, that creatinine is double what it was the last time. That's probably quite important. And just not thinking of those fixed boundaries of the reference interval. And some of my other work has shown that most of the reference intervals that we're provided with are wrong to start with. And so that's sort of another freak out, because people who are only looking for the asterisks of that's high, that's low, they're going to be missing out a whole lot of stuff. And thinking about it as gray areas is a way to do it, even without the high-end calculations that some of you have seen in some of my presentations. And I only really show those calculations to just show that there is a true science behind this variation of the numbers. I don't expect people to be making the calculations on the regular basis. Mm-hmm. But like I said, I hope to have these tools available, hopefully within a year or so. There's been a lot of background work getting it together that is going to make it a whole lot more obvious to practitioners where those limits are and where those gray areas are.
Gerardo? I can see your head spinning. It's like...
Picked up a whole... No, I guess the Pandora's box, there was hope at the end. So, you know...
That's what I mean. When I first read it, it's almost an emotional response of... Damn it. but once you get your head around it, and I'm going to dig into it a little bit more to clarify it, because once you get it, it's actually, then it's almost like, oh, duh, it makes so much sense, but I've just never thought of it that way. Gerardo, have you got questions, or can I start digging?
Oh, no, you start digging. I'm sure we'll get clarity. We'll come about this.
Yeah. So we'll come back to where exactly that variation occurs. But just to clarify what you said about the gray zone. So does that mean... And we'll come back to your comments about reference zones as well, because that's also something we just take for as gospel. But if my result, let's say I do a result, let's say creatinine, and it's nice low middle of the reference range or low reference range, I can trust that because your gray zone, and if you say gray zone, let's say my result is X, but you're saying there should be X plus or minus. Mm-hmm. Why?
Look, so, as a general rule,
yeah,
well within normal, well elevated, well down, you can pretty well be confident on the result. Okay. If you've got a creatinine in a cat that's 700, you're not worried about gray areas.
Okay, gotcha. Yeah.
Okay. If you have a creatinine in a cat that's 40 or 50, that's well below normal, you think, oh yeah, when I did take the blood sample, the cat was a 2 out of 9 body condition score, has no muscle mass. That's why that creatinine. Middle of the range is a little bit trickier because just say your range is 70 to 170. Okay. So picking some numbers there. Mm-hmm. And you have a 130 or 140.
Yeah.
If it happens to be that that cat's normal is about 100, 130 to 140 might be an elevation. So the middle of the range just can be sort of still a little bit, can still be a little bit tricky. And essentially the best way to look at it, and it's very hard in your areas of emergency medicine because you're looking at the one-offs, but for the general practitioners out there, getting the regular results, and a lot of people are cynical about wellness checks, and wellness, let's make no bones about it, wellness checks came about as an economic idea, not really looking for things, but there is a real reason for it now, and that is knowing what normal is for the individual. Wow. So if you know that this cat's had creatinine of 105, 115, 110, and if people now look at, if they're driving to work and they get to work and they look at a particular cat and they look back in the previous years, they will see that the creatinines do fall around a really narrow range most of the time. The ALPs fall around a really narrow range most of the time. The ALTs do. So looking at those, you can pick the changes. But if you don't have that, then looking, is it very high? Is it very low? Is it somewhere near the middle? Is a very good starting point.
Mm. Yeah, no, I get what you're saying. Because when I look at some biochems and things like that, it's if the ALT is like 50 above normal or something like that, normal range, and like clinically look at the dog and see what's going on and try to put a clinical pictures. But if the ALT is like 1500 or something, then it's like, okay, I believe that.
Yep, definitely. And ALPs in cats in particular is important. It's got a short half-life. So anything that's anywhere near the top of normal for that. And that's the other thing, when you've done work with clinical pathology, you get to know which ones have the specific vagaries like that short half-life in ALP.
Mm.
Are there any of the things that we commonly measure that have a bigger variation that we should be more wary of?
So let me give you the general rules of variation.
Okay.
If the body has to regulate it really tightly, it stays within a narrow range.
Okay.
So if your electrolytes aren't, your sodium and chloride aren't in a narrow range, mm-hmm. then your nervous system isn't going to work properly because it's not going to be firing those electrical charges through properly. So that's in a narrow range. If your albumin isn't within a narrow range, you're going to have your plasma falling out of your cells. So that's got to be in a narrow range.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, the ranges that we find for things like albumin, calcium, sodium, chloride, they're similar across all mammals, cats, dogs, people, horses. So and it's not surprising when you think about it. There's reasons for it. The things that vary more are things like the bilirubin, creatine kinase, that sort of thing. One of the analytes that I've done some recent work at looking at is SDMA. And SDMA has really too much variation to be used as a routine screening tool for glomerular filtration rate, that is dehydration or kidney disease. So it has a significant amount more variation than creatinine does. So a result at the upper limit of the reference interval of 14 actually represents anywhere between 8 and 20. So you basically need over 20 to be really confident that your SDMA is true elevation.
And conversely, if it's a little bit high on your results, does that mean actually it could be well within the normal and your early diagnosis of kidney failure is not necessarily accurate?
Yeah, that's exactly right. And okay. I had someone post on Vina that they had a series of results from a cat, and they were like, oh, the cat had kidney disease improved, then it had kidney disease again, and it was this oscillating in and out. And I showed her the numbers and I said, this fits in perfectly with what we know, the dispersion. And that's what that variation around the individual result is called, dispersion. Okay. That fits in perfectly with what we expect the dispersion to be. And these results all represent the same result. So cat hasn't varied at all.
Oh, wow.
Hmm.
And is that dispersion, and I'm not talking specifically SDMA, is that mainly in the animal or is it in the machine or is it a combination of both?
It varies.
Varies.
So more in the animal than in the machine.
Okay.
Let's put it that way. So that's how much it varies in the animal than the machine. But if you, I want to try and keep these ideas relatively simple, but you can imagine if something varies very little in the body,
mm-hmm.
that you want to have the machine variation vary less than that.
Yeah.
So if, for example, you've got something that varies about 10% as creatinine does, then you want to have your machine variation less than 5%, because if it's 10% or more, you can't tell if the variation is in the animal or in the machine. So, and that's where that paper that I had rejected that got me into this area was saying, this is how we need to know, this is what we need to compare against.
We have... like, as you said before, in emergency, you might see a case once only ever, and you're going to make a call on variations that you see in the biochemistry panel. But then the variation then you get when you send it away to the lab for external assessment as well. Sometimes we send some blood away just to check, see whether or not the elevation that we got is, you know, significant or not significant, but is real. Is there much variation between in-house machines and external lab machines?
I want to freak you out a huge amount more. There's not only variation between in-house machines and lab machines, and that's called bias or accuracy, that amount of variation in between machines. But you can have two lab machines that are top of the range $500,000 machines, and if they're not calibrated to be the give exactly the same result, they can give different results. So for example, if you're sending, and I'm not going to mention any commercial labs because I don't want to cast aspersions on anyone in particular, but if you're sending to your regular lab in Sydney and their analyzer is down and they send to a lab in Melbourne, Adelaide or Brisbane, unless they've specifically calibrated their machines between the labs, they can have a variation between their results. And I mentioned my mentor on this clinical pathology pathway, Kathleen Breeman, the American who's in Scotland, at the group of labs that she currently works with. She has one of her clinical pathologists doing a PhD because they recognized that they had variations between on their hematology machines. And until they got SysMex out, they couldn't adjust it. They needed to get SysMex out to adjust the machines to calibrate them to give the same results, but they needed to tell SysMex exactly what to do. So just be aware when you're getting your own blood samples that there could be machine variation with that as well as, and of course there is the biological variation with that. The in-house analyzers are very good within their own universe. So if you compare how much the same sample, how repeatable a sample is, and that's a really important concept. So that's called imprecision. So how precise the result is. So 10 of the same samples will not give the same result, but you want to have that percentage variation as relatively low. If you are just keeping within the universe of your in-house analyzer, the in-house analyzers are very good and I've demonstrated multiple times comparable to the lab analyzers. But the comparison between the in-house and the lab is, and it varies by analyte, it can vary by concentration. So there, you're doing the animal the disservice by confirming at the outside lab. You're better off confirming it on your equipment. And this sort of concept that the outside lab is better. It's not better if it's different. You've got to be the same analyzer. And even if we swap in-house analyzers of the same brand at our practice, we'll run a series of tests to make sure that we're getting the same results from the same in-house analyzer. And they're relatively close, but they're not exactly the same, the same in-house. And as my friend Kathy demonstrated in her series of labs overseas, that even at the high-end lab equipment are not giving exactly the same result. So did I succeed in freaking you out more?
Yeah. So now it's trying to swing it back into, you know, so you said before, it's, if it's high, then it's significant. And if it's low or low normal, then you're pretty comfortable with the Oscan range. But then you got the high normal to above normal, above reference range, where it's kind of like...
Just recheck it.
Yeah.
Just recheck it. And look,
the on your own machine. Sorry to interrupt you. If you say
on the same machine, recheck it.
Just rerun it.
I guess in the emergency situation, the other thing that's really important is that you're expecting that those changes are going to be big. Like you're getting the cats and dogs and your occasional ferrets in these acute situations. So if a change is a subtle, or like, oh, this does look high normal. Could this be important? Like, does it fit the clinical signs? Like, does it make sense? And I think that very basic question of, does that make sense to say that this creatinine is elevated is an important thing.
Yeah, that's the question I commonly get asked. Like, hey, Gerardo, what do we do with these blood results? It's got these elevations here, but, and it's like, nah, well, look, you know, what's it in for? What's the signs showing? And the kind of, you know, how does it look? And then it always comes down to, is it clinically significant? Not like it's above normal, but is that the thing that's causing the disease?
Can you relate to the disease? And you know, and it comes down to this thing that's called thinking about it. You know, sometimes it's just not. You know, the humans talk about asteriskosis, like they're diagnosing by the asterisks on the blood result. You know, so if you're waiting for the asterisks, you're you know, it probably works most of the time, but if you're trying to judge by the asterisks the whole time, you won't get the whole picture. And, you know, I've just thought of this off the bat as an idea, just because I haven't thought too much about the emergency situation. If it's going to need ongoing monitoring at the referring practice, if you take a sample that you have enough plasma to run there and for them to run it as a test there, then they have, and you know what? Okay. Maybe there'll be variation on the one-off result, but it'll give you a starting point for comparison. And you can say, yeah, we got the same on that occasion, so we can judge it the same way. Or we got five different, you know, so on our creatinine, you know, the 185 was 180. And we can think of that as close enough to being the same. So that's probably not a bad strategy to perform. And I think if you explain to the clients, look, the machines can be a bit different. So what we want to do is do a test here. And because they'll be doing the ongoing tests there, we're going to send a little bit to them also. And I think the clients will be receptive to that. So
I think that's important, is that talking to the clients about it, because I think clients are the same. They see those tests as definitive, and we want them to be definitive as gospel, and actually prepping them to say, well, look, we have this result. It could be, definitely we need to follow up on it, but it's not necessarily the absolute truth, and we have to recheck it or something like that.
I find clients are very receptive to the idea of, they're confident with the idea of personalized medicine in people. Now, we can't call it personalized in our clients, so we say individualized. And so they're really open to the concept of that. And so I think that being aware that this is not showing up as being abnormal within the population range, but it may be important for Fluffy. And so if we can just recheck that for Fluffy and see that it's going to be a matter of testing on a regular basis to make sure that this change that looks normal within the population is actually relevant for Fluffy.
I want to go back. You mentioned earlier, we talked about those health checks. And then when I asked you just now about those gray zones, and you said recheck on the same machine, are we... Let's go to a scenario outside of emergency. So GP patient, they come in for a health check. There's a result that's borderline. Do you mean recheck that same sample on the same machine, or come back in a week and recheck?
There's two things to do. If you're confident in your equipment, you shouldn't need to do that. But if you think that that elevation could be important, maybe if it's borderline for kidney disease and we're not expecting a big change, you just check it 3 months later.
Okay.
If it's something that you want to actually look to potentially treat, then maybe a week later, a month later, something like that. And of course, we've got to get this balance between what's right for the client as well. You know, they're not endless money pits, and I'm not trying to suggest that that you do multiple tests and run up thousands of dollars for the client. You know, have a bit of common sense with it. So I talked about being competent in your equipment, and that's the imprecision I was talking about before and the repeatability. And I think the in-house equipment people should be giving all practitioners 20 reagents to run on a daily basis once a year. And I think that that should show confidence in their equipment and then provide the software that that they can work out how much percent variation there is in those results, because those results aren't going to be all the same.
So they provide 20 samples of a known...
They provide 20 like reagents to 20 slides to run, like 20 tests or discs with the Abaxis. So they provide 20 panels for you to run. And then you can run them either on the quality control material that they supply, or I actually think it's better if you get pooled plasma. So basically over about a week period, when you draw off your sample, when you spin it down, you don't need all of it. So if you put the rest of it in a jar, just keep it for a week. And then if you freeze that into separate little amounts and then run it once a day. So I understand that most people don't want to do that in practice, and using the quality control material is not a bad second. And it's certainly a lot better than doing nothing at all. And in fact, most of the labs use the quality control material. So I want to draw the distinction between the pooled plasma or serum, but I'm comfortable with the quality control material. And you run that same sample daily, just on the weekdays, on 20 occasions, even 10 occasions is useful. And given that the labs, the in-house analyzer companies aren't paying for that, I think you work out how much did that cost me to do, and you amortize that and you increase the amount of your tests by that amount, so you're not losing out on it. And if you're doing something like 3 tests each weekday, so let's say 15 tests a week, let's multiply it by 50 instead of the 52. Out of 450 tests, if you're running 10 extra or 20 extra, that's not a whole lot extra. Okay. And that amount extra that you're adding to those, the cost of that to the client is not a huge amount. And that will give you that basic number of how much your analyzer varies. And there are then guidelines you can look up for how much is acceptable for that. And how much is acceptable varies depending on what we're measuring. I talked about before that you've got your sodium and your chlorides that have very, very little variation. And in fact, to reach the very high standards of that, even lab equipment doesn't reach the best possible standards of that. But you just want it to be minimal variation, like something like around 1% maximum. You've got a bit more leeway when you come to your bilirubins and creatine kinases, for example.
Okay, so when you're saying pool, just clarifying, you had 10 patients came in, and then you just got little bits of their 10 patient plasmas to get together.
And you mix it all up like in a urine sample jar and keep it in the fridge all week, but pretty well not longer than a week is a way to do. And then you want to make sure that you've got enough to run a number of samples. So that's your best assessment. So here we are getting into one of my complicated areas a bit. When we have the quality control material, that isn't giving exactly the same results that you'd get with plasma or serum. And in fact, serum and plasma don't necessarily give the same results. And this is another thing that they're sort of thought of as the same. And in most of the time they are. Your ALP and ALT, your plasma and serum, should give the same result in creatinine. Glucose, a lot of people realize that that's different. Potassium is one that people don't realize is different in serum compared to plasma. So again, it's this consistency of, did I collect it in a plain top tube or a lithium heparin tube? Just have the consistency in your practice. Personally, I prefer plasma, lithium heparin samples. To me, that's more like what's happening in the body, because with serum, we allow that plot to form, and there's variations that occur with that. But there is, for most of the things that we measure, there is no practical difference between whether you're doing serum or plasma. Again, it's another rabbit hole.
So when you're doing that, so you've got this pool of blood, so you mix it all together, so you've got one sample, and then what you're looking, so then you run a, let's say a profile 2 or your standard profile, run it on that same sample 10 days in a row, and you're just looking for any of the reagents that varies wildly between the different samples. Is that what you're looking for?
Yeah, as a warning sign? And look, you can make it look, if you're comfortable with Excel, you can make a simple spreadsheet that you just look at the numbers there. You work out the mean of the results after the 10 or 20 days. And then the other value you want is the standard deviation. Standard deviation divided by mean is coefficient of variation. I did put on a year, 2 years ago, something like that, on continuing veterinary education, I did put a spreadsheet on there to show people how to do that. I am sure that if you Googled imprecision Excel, that there'd be stuff out there to just that you can just put the numbers in and don't have to do the calculations yourself.
Brilliant.
But it doesn't have to be the pooled plasma or serum if that seems like too much work.
Okay.
Use the quality control material that they've got. That's what most of the labs do.
Uh-huh.
And that's that much easier. And like I said, that's better than not knowing how much variation, how much imprecision happens at all.
Okay, good. One more thing. We mentioned reference ranges. You seemed a little bit not that clear on. So our reference ranges, that's gospel. You don't argue with that. Is that not the case? Let's ask it this way. Do you, in your practice, have you got reference ranges that are different to the?
I've calculated out the reference intervals for our in-house analyzer. So I use different to what they've provided. So yes, that is the answer to that. I think that we need to go back with that and try and remember what our reference interval actually represents. And I think that a lot of practitioners forget, and I don't actually remember being taught, I'm sure I was, but despite my academic prowess in these areas and writing papers and stuff, I actually wasn't a very good student. So I sort of came to sort of working and studying later. So I probably was taught it and forgot. But the reference interval is a representation of what we expect normal to be. And essentially you get a series of results. You look at it in a normal distribution, so your normal bell curve, and you're looking at the central 95% of that normal bell curve. It is a mathematical construct. It is not to do with pathology. And so there is a difference between being outside the reference interval and having pathology. There is this logic leap that you take that if you are within the reference interval, because that's the representation of healthy, that means that if you're outside the reference interval, then you can expect that that's probably not healthy. But it's a logic leap. And I'll give you an obvious example of where that falls down somewhat. Our definition of diabetes is having a persistent elevation of blood glucose above the renal threshold. So the renal threshold in cats is somewhere in the realm of 15, 16 millimoles per litre. But your reference intervals for glucose are going to be in the realms of 7.5, 8. So you can be outside that reference interval at a level of 9.5, 10, and not be diabetic because we're not above the renal threshold. So I think that's sort of the most obvious example that I can come across. And then you can say, oh, is it stress? Is it pre-diabetes? And yeah, there are reasons for it, but any elevation of glucose outside the reference interval doesn't mean that there's a problem. And I think you've got to come back to this idea that the reference interval is a probability construct, not a definition of disease. So when you have these limits beyond which it's disease, they're called decision thresholds. And for diabetes, that your decision threshold is that you're over the renal threshold. And that means that you're getting the glucose spilling over into the urine. That's why you're seeing it in the urine as well as the blood. So that's what your reference interval is. And then you've got to think about, how do I determine that? And the way that you determine it, your gold standard number of healthy individuals is 120. And so I can go into the reasons why it's 120, and it's mathematical reasons as well, so I won't. But you can imagine that if a lab gets a new analyzer, that they've got to get 120 dogs, healthy dogs, cats, horses, ferrets, rabbits. So I've spoken to pathologists at commercial labs and I said, oh, how did you determine your reference intervals? And the first answer you get is, oh, we determine by robust method if it's this, and standard method if it's that, and non-parametric method, you know, these statisticals, and they'll give me the textbook answer of how you're meant to. And I go, yeah, yeah, but how did you determine your reference intervals? And then they'll tell you quietly on the side, no, actually, I've been here 6 years. We've changed our equipment in that time and we're using the same reference intervals as before. And that's because it's expensive. You know, if you're running a full profile of biochemistry and hematology, let alone all your endocrine things on dogs, cats, horses, cattle, rabbits.
Yeah.
You know, you start doing the sums of it and it's thousands upon thousands of dollars. So then you have the problem of the in-house analyzers, and I'll have my equipment in Sydney, Australia, and it'll flash out a reference interval range that's the same as someone in Paris, someone in London, someone in New York. It's not the same population of cats. It's a different population of cats. Mm. Even when we determine those reference intervals, you've got to have this standardization of doing it. So firstly, you want to have 120 healthy animals. What's healthy?
Yeah.
And there's a big question on even in this on the human side of things, like, oh, do we include smokers, non-smokers? Is it the general population? You know, do we include people who are obese, a bit overweight? Then if we go on the veterinary side where people, where the cat can't say, hey, I'm feeling a little bit off today.
Yeah.
So we're doing it on physical exam. There's this sort of circular argument that you don't want to be doing it on the blood tests because you're doing the blood test on a healthy animal. You know? So as long as you've got definitions that you're sticking within, and I'm comfortable on a physical examination and weight stable to previously and, you know, that sort of thing, heart rate stable, and I'm not having any obvious signs, I'm happy for that to be the case for my reference intervals. And without trying to confuse listeners too much, take it as a round number, put a gray area around it and have a big gray area around it. I'm not expecting everyone to go out and get their 120 healthy patients and calculate it out for themselves, because that's just not practical to do. But if you put a gray area around it and just don't take it as gospel, and don't do this asteriskosis that we were talking about, treading on the asterisks, then that's the wise way to go about it.
Or if you are in Sydney and you treat cats often, phone Randolph and ask him for his reference.
Except that only applies to my analyzer.
Analyzer, there you go.
My nurses will hate me.
Well, so when I was at uni, they went through multiples of the normal or something like that, like multiples above the reference ranges.
Oh, yeah.
So ALT 2 times above normal is significant. Amylase, I don't know, was it 5 times above normal is significant, or creatine kinase or something like heaps above normal, you know, for when it's really significant. Is there some kind of rough guidelines that you have that help out there, or is it just combination of how high it is, how the patient's looking, does it fit the picture kind of thing?
Yeah, I think more the latter. I don't mind rules of thumb like that. And there's, for horses, there are all these sorts of rules of thumb, and creatine kinase above this amount is rhabdomyolysis, and potassium increasing this amount. And what they've done is that they've put it in terms of biological variation and basically looked at these rules of thumb and how many of them are real and how many of them aren't. And the creatinine kinase one for rhabdomyolysis is almost exactly right. I can't remember what the numbers are. I don't know horses well enough to know the numbers, but
40,000 or something. I don't know.
The rule of thumb, something like three times in elevation, but I don't recall. The potassium one is really wrong because you have too much variation in potassium. And so what the trainers think is healthy or not healthy is basically within the margins of the variation within the individual and the machine. But reassuringly, these sort of rules of thumb, like three quarters of them actually work out, and there's stuff that trainers and vets have just worked out over time. And that's what I was saying before about specialists having these ideas and putting the gray areas on naturally. So intuition and experience does count for something, you know. Oh, whenever I see this above that, it normally means that I can be confident that there's a problem. But just don't take them as entire gospel. Just have this element of doubt in your mind about it. And essentially, what I'm trying to say is don't get hung up about it. Don't throw all your blood tests out and think that it's all useless either, but just put gray areas around it and just don't take the numbers as absolute fact. And if something doesn't make sense, recheck it. Rule number one of weird results, recheck. Mm-hmm. And whether it's a week later or a month later, you know, you work that out with a client.
One other question, the whole dilution thing. What's your thoughts around the accuracy of that dilution?
You lose accuracy, but yeah. I like to have an idea. So I like to recommend dilution. So for example, if I've got a cat that's hyperthyroid and the T4 is greater than 146 or whatever their upper limit of the range is, I want to know if I've given carbimazole or whatever, that when I get it back at 130, is that just a bit of a drop or is it a lot of a drop? So if the dilution comes back and says that greater than 145 was 160, I know it's a bit of a drop and not a lot of a drop. If it was 300 to start with, coming down to 135 is more of a change, but I still need more of it. So I want to know how much difference I'm making. You know, the dehydrated dog or cat and your urea and creatinine are over normal. You know, the urethral stones as an issue and you have this acute kidney injury. If you've got creatinine, say, greater than 600 and urea greater than 45, how much is your diuresis? How much is your diuresis helped when the next time you do it? And so I don't take it as an absolute number. And so we talked about gray areas, and the gray area becomes even
bigger.
Yeah. But it gives you some idea and it tells you how much change you're making. And if we don't have a number to compare with it first, we can't see how much change we're making.
Gotcha.
Yeah. Yeah.
No. You know, you asked about these rules of thumb. Billy Rubin's a good one for a rule of thumb. Billy Rubin is the assessment is done is by the colour. And if you can see that it's a bit yellow, even if it's not saying there's an elevation, that's relevant. Any yellow in the plasma tells you that there's more bilirubin there than there should be. So I think that always look at your plasma. And if you had a really hard time getting the sample and the sample's all really hemolyzed, take your numbers with a grain of salt and try and get a better sample and do a better one after.
Yeah.
Randolph, you're clearly very passionate and very knowledgeable about this. I think this is going to open some minds. Hopefully we don't get vets pacing around up and down in the clinics, chewing their nails going, I don't know.
I don't think people should freak out about it, but I think that it's better to be forewarned and have the knowledge there and have simple ways to work around it. And I'm not saying that people need to work out their own reference intervals or that sort of stuff, but work out your precision, work out the imprecision that you've got of your own analyzer and amortize it across the whole year. Work out how many tests you do in a year and you'll be able to easily make your money back without charging your clients too much more.
Awesome. If somebody wants to dig deeper and find out more, I know you're online with this sort of stuff. Where can people go and find out about this more or find you and your work?
Look, I think probably the best bet is go to the vetbiologicalvariation.org website. But if you Google vet biological variation, you'll find it. Okay. And I keep a database there of all the papers on it, and there's information that explains about biological variation. So I think that that's a good place to start. That doesn't cover all the areas that we've talked about with reference intervals and that sort of thing, but that's a good place with the biological variation stuff to have a look. I wrote with a couple of colleagues a Journal of Veterinary Internal Medicine paper that came out end of last year that is clinical applications of biological variation. I hope that's not too dense for practitioners, but I'll come back when we've got our tools on and I can tell people about the tools that we've got that'll make these things easier to use in practice as well.
Okay, excellent. Send me any links that you want and we'll put them in the show notes so people can click on it and just go straight to your work. But I think this is important stuff to talk about. And thank you so much for making the time to share it with us.
Thanks. Thanks for making the time for me. I appreciate it.
You know those conversations that you have at conferences, back in the days when we still had big vet conferences, when people are chatting to the lecturers and asking questions, and you hear things like, this isn't really in the books, but here's what I think. It's in those kinds of conversations that the best nuggets of wisdom appear, the nitty-gritty real-life details that you can only get from years and years of experience. And it's exactly those kinds of conversations that we try to emulate on the Vet Vault Clinical Podcasts. We don't want lectures. We want to hear about the challenges, the tips, the stuff-ups, the this is how I do it. Go to vvn.supercast.tech to join in the conversation.